GoDaddy.com. Use the code BLU139 to get 10% off any combination of purchases at GoDaddy.com. See site for details. Get your piece of the internet at GoDaddy.com. Tango Tango Papa 1122, July 27, 2009.
Have we seen the actual reality of a monster's crime? Or merely an illusion, the product of a tortured brain?
Thank you.
from the PodSafe Music Network. Well, that's not quite true anymore. I found out they changed the name to Music Alley. So from musicalley.com, that is Josh Lopez, and the name of that is Take Me to This Place. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Tom Wiles here with you, coming to you this evening from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Got here, upwards of 2 hours ago. Got here and answered some email, got on the computer, answered some email, read some news stories, downloaded some video, and before I knew it, 2 hours was up. So I'm unloading here at 8 a.m., which that's Eastern time, so right now it would be 2:25, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So probably in about roughly 5.5 hours from now, be unloading. And I've still kind of gotten day turned into night and night turned into day. I spent the night, I left Rockmart, Georgia. Let me think about this. Saturday afternoon. And then I stopped at Wytheville, Virginia. And so I ended up, I think I did a podcast from there. The last podcast. And then that was Friday. Friday night I got to with Wytheville, Virginia. Wytheville, whatever they call it. Got there Friday. And then didn't leave there until this afternoon. So I was there for over 24 hours because there was really no need to hurry on up here to Pittsburgh. And that truck stop there was as good as any. So left there this afternoon, and then I got here, I guess it was about 11:40, or, 12:40 their time here, 12:40 Eastern time. So, while I was at Wytheville, I slept a couple of times, and then, spent a good chunk of the night last night, watching a lot of the, I've got a ton of videos that I've downloaded from video podcasts in iTunes. So I spent a bunch of time watching more of those TED conference videos. And some of those are more interesting than others. Most of them are relatively interesting. And so watch some more of those, and basically just, didn't have much better to do, so here I was up in the middle of the night kind of watching that, and then I guess it was about 6:30 or so this morning, or it might have been 7:30 my time, went, laid down, closed the curtains, went to bed, and then I set my alarm for about, I had it set for about 2 o'clock. I woke up at 1:30 and then, continued to lay there. And then the alarm went off, and I think it went off about 2 or 3 times before I went ahead and, got up and got myself around and got headed on up here to Pittsburgh. So I've said it before, Pittsburgh is a weird city. Just because of where it's at, how it's laid out, it's not a city that you're not going to be driving through here unless you're either on your way to Erie, Pennsylvania, you happen to be from the, coming from the south, and you're on your way to Erie, Pennsylvania, you might drive through Pittsburgh, but otherwise, you're just not going to be driving through here. Because Interstate 70 goes through quite a ways south of here, and so you have to deliberately be coming here in order to end up in Pittsburgh. And then it's just, it's very strange the way the place is laid out. I don't know quite how to describe it. Every other city in the country is that I've ever been to is laid out very differently than Pittsburgh is. Pittsburgh, you never really know that you're here. You know, it's kind of the way it's laid out, the way the roads are laid out. You know, the downtown area is kind of, because of the topography, the downtown area is kind of in a small area, you know, and they've got some big tall buildings in downtown Pittsburgh, but you'd never see them unless you happen to get, I guess there's a valley right there where those rivers are, where they all come together, and you know you see them then, but otherwise you're in other parts of town, and even though you may be in the city limits, you'd never know it. It's more like a, because of the topography, it's kind of like you're in more of a rural area a lot of the time. And then the roads themselves are really screwy. You've got a lot of two-lane freeway type things, you know, and you know, like, now once coming, you know, once I got close to this place, this I'm at a coal storage that's kind of north, you know, it's sort of north of downtown Pittsburgh by, you know, 2 or 3 miles, I don't know, several miles. You cross through this tunnel, and then you cross this, I think you cross a bridge, and then all of a sudden, or you come out of this tunnel, and you know, and I think, what was it, Interstate 279, it's really screwy because all of a sudden you got all these roads going every which way. They split off every which way. And fortunately, I was able to stay on the right road, but you've got to jump over a bunch of lanes. And, you know, within a short period of time, I had to keep changing lanes several times in order to keep going the way I wanted to go on Interstate 279. And then went a ways, and then I cut off on another, I think it was Pennsylvania State Highway 28. But it's just, it's really a mess the way the place is laid out. And you know, now of course they probably built ended up becoming a city. I think it's been, you know, this has been inhabited probably for I don't really know the history of it, but it's been inhabited probably for hundreds of years. And so they've had all this stuff that built up in this topography without, you know, and a lot of it was probably set up for horse and buggies. And, you know, when they started building, you know, modern roads, you know, then you run into the problem that they've had in other big eastern cities, northeastern cities. People don't want to give up their land for roads. And so you end up with really screwy little roads. So tomorrow, I don't know where they will be having me, you know, have me pick a load up once I leave here. I have no clue. Depending on, you know, if it's during the day when I leave here, because I'm going to come back, park back here in the back of this coal storage if they'll let me, and sleep some more once I've unloaded, and then they'll send another load. And they've got places to pick loads up around here. So, but I don't really know. Depending on what time of day, I could see where the traffic, you know, just the normal city traffic, people driving around, could be a real problem on the, you know, because these are some really screwy little streets and little semi, they're not even real freeways, almost. So, But Pittsburgh is interesting. It's just it's unlike any other city that you would ever go to anywhere in North America, probably, or at least the U.S. and Canada, that I've ever been to. It's just it's a weird weird place. So, but anyway, I'm here and we'll be unloading, and then we'll see where they send me after that. I've got, I found what I did. I can't play all of this, but I was looking online and I found some video on YouTube of Sarah Palin kind of giving her farewell. You know, she's resigning as governor. She only had like a little over a year left in her term. And so she's been, you know, after McCain nominated her for his vice presidential his vice presidential running mate. The you know, there's a lot of people that really like her, including me. You know, I really like the woman. She's really like, you know, the way she's able to articulate my values. And of course, the Democrats in her state and the Democrats nationally are the enemy. Well, let's just, instead of saying Democrats, you know, let's just say the enemies of the values that I believe in and the values that many Americans believe in. The enemies of those values have gone after her in a big way, and they've really started, you know, they're trying to destroy her. After this, you know, even after she lost McCain lost the presidential race to Obama, you know, they're mostly Democrats, but there have been forces arrayed against her trying to destroy her, because she does a really good job of articulating the values that many Americans hold, including me. And so they've been after her, and so now she decided, yep, I'm not going to, this is causing all kinds of problems for the state of Alaska. I've gotten everything done, or most everything done that I wanted to get done. I'm going to just, you know, resign and take the pressure off of the state of Alaska, and you know, and she can go about her business, and maybe one day she'll run for president. And by the way, I would vote for her. So, but I've got that. I've got her farewell speech. And then, and so in the meantime, I also, when I was searching on YouTube, there was also, that came up in the search results, Ronald Reagan's last speech that he gave from the Oval Office. Now, and so what I want to do, I want to play Ronald Reagan, you know, because, you know, Reagan is, you know, at the, Reagan is just, you know, even though the man's dead and he's been dead for a while now, and it's been a long time since he was president, he was so inspiring. And there's something about Reagan that, you know, that, you know, I don't know quite how to express it, but there's a spirit that comes through. You know, you hear them, you know, you hear a recording of him, or you see the video recording of him, and you listen to him talk, and there's some kind of a spirit that you see, you know, that comes through, that reaches right through, and it really repels you, and people, you know, it would drive people crazy that hate that, or for the majority of people, they loved it. And so, you know, I'm going to go ahead and play I've got two segments, and they're both about 10 minutes each. This is broken up into two parts because I got it off of YouTube. And so I'm going to go ahead and play that now. So this is part one of Ronald Reagan's last address, his farewell address from the Oval Office at the end of his presidency.
My fellow Americans, this is the 34th time I'll speak to you from the Oval Office, and the last. We've been together 8 years now, and soon it'll be time for me to go. But before I do, I wanted to share some thoughts, some of which I've been saving for a long time. It's been the honor of my life to be your president. So many of you have written the past few weeks to say thanks, but I could say as much to you. Nancy and I are grateful for the opportunity you gave us to serve. One of the things about the presidency is that you're always somewhat apart. You spend a lot of time going by too fast in a car someone else is driving and seeing the people through tinted glass, the parents holding up a child, and the wave you saw too late and couldn't return. And so many times I wanted to stop and reach out from behind the glass and connect. Well, maybe I can do a little of that tonight. People ask how I feel about leaving, and the fact is, parting is such sweet sorrow. The sweet part is California and the ranch and freedom. The sorrow, the goodbyes, of course, and leaving this beautiful place. You know, down the hall and up the stairs from this office is the part of the White House where the president and his family live. There are a few favorite windows I have up there that I like to stand and look out of early in the morning. The view is over the grounds here to the Washington Monument and then the Mall and the Jefferson Memorial. But on mornings when the humidity is low, you can see past the Jefferson to the river, the Potomac, and the Virginia shore. Someone said that's the view Lincoln had when he saw the smoke rising from the Battle of Bull Run. Well, I see more prosaic things. The grass on the banks, the morning traffic as people make their way to work, now and then a sailboat on the river. I've been thinking a bit at that window. I've been reflecting on what the past 8 years have meant and mean. And the image that comes to mind like a refrain is a nautical one. A small story about a big ship and a refugee and a sailor. It was back in the early 80s, at the height of the boat people, and the sailor was hard at work on the carrier Midway, which was patrolling the South China Sea. The sailor, like most American servicemen, was young, smart, and fiercely observant. The crew spied on the horizon a leaky little boat, and crammed inside were refugees from Indochina, hoping to get to America. The Midway sent a small launch to bring them to the ship in safety. As the refugees made their way through the choppy seas, one spied the sailor on deck and stood up and called out to him. He yelled, "Hello, American sailor. Hello, freedom man." A small moment with a big meaning. A moment the sailor, who wrote it in a letter, couldn't get out of his mind. And when I saw it, neither could I. Because that's what it was to be an American in the 1980s. We stood again for freedom. I know we always have, but in the past few years, the world, again and in a way, we ourselves rediscovered it. It's been quite a journey this decade, and we held together through some stormy seas. And at the end, together, we're reaching our destination. The fact is, from Grenada to the Washington and Moscow summits, from the recession of 81 to 82, to the expansion that began in late 82 and continues to this day, we've made a difference. The way I see it, there were two great triumphs, two things that I'm proudest of. One is the economic recovery, in which the people of America created and filled 19 million new jobs. The other is the recovery of our morale. America is respected again in the world and looked to for leadership. Something that happened to me a few years ago reflects some of this. It was back in 1981, and I was attending my first big economic summit, which was held that year in Canada. The meeting place rotates among the member countries. The opening meeting was a formal dinner for the heads of government of the seven industrialized nations. Well, I sat there like the new kid in school and listened. And it was all Francois this and Helmut that. They dropped titles and spoke to one another on a first-name basis. Well, at one point, I sort of leaned in and said, "My name's Ron." But in that same year, we began the actions we felt would ignite an economic comeback, cut taxes and regulation, started to cut spending. Soon the recovery began. 2 years later, another economic summit with pretty much the same cast. At the big opening meeting, we all got together, and all of a sudden, just for a moment, I saw that everyone was just sitting there looking at me. And then one of them broke the silence. "Tell us about the American miracle," he said. Well, back in 1980, when I was running for president, it was all so different. Some pundits said our programs would result in catastrophe. Our views on foreign affairs would cause war. Our plans for the economy would cause inflation to soar and bring about economic collapse. I even remember one highly respected economist saying back in 1982 that the engines of economic growth have shut down here, and they're likely to stay that way for years to come. Well, he and the other opinion leaders were wrong. The fact is, what they called radical was really right. What they called dangerous was just desperately needed. And in all of that time, I won a nickname, the Great Communicator. But I never thought it was my style or the words I used that made a difference. It was the content. I wasn't a great communicator, but I communicated great things. And they didn't spring full bloom from my brow. They came from the heart of a great nation, from our experience, our wisdom, and our belief in the principles that have guided us for two centuries. They called it the Reagan Revolution. Well, I'll accept that. But for me, it always seemed more like the great rediscovery, a rediscovery of our values and our common sense. Common sense told us that when you put a big tax on something, the people will produce less of it. So we cut the people's tax rates, and the people produced more than ever before. The economy bloomed like a plant that had been cut back and could now grow quicker and stronger. Our economic program brought about the longest peacetime expansion in our history. Real family income up, the poverty rate down, entrepreneurship booming, and an explosion in research and new technology. We're exporting more now than ever because American industry became more competitive. And at the same time, we summoned the national will to knock down protectionist walls abroad instead of erecting them at home. Common sense also told us that to preserve the peace, we'd have to become strong again after years of weakness and confusion. So we rebuilt our defenses. And this new year, we toasted the new peacefulness around the globe. Not only have the superpowers actually begun to reduce their stockpiles of nuclear weapons, and hope for even more progress is bright, but the regional conflicts that rack the globe are also beginning to cease. The Persian Gulf is no longer a war zone. The Soviets are leaving Afghanistan. The Vietnamese are preparing to pull out of Cambodia. And an American-mediated accord will soon send 50,000 Cuban troops home from Angola. The lesson of all this was, of course, that because we're a great nation, our challenges seem complex. It will always be this way. But as long as we remember our first principles and believe in ourselves, the future will always be ours. And something else we learned. Once you begin a great movement, there's no telling where it'll end. We meant to change a nation, and instead, we changed a world. Countries across the globe are turning to free markets and free speech, and turning away from the ideologies of the past. For them, the great rediscovery of the 1980s has been that, lo and behold, the moral way of government is the practical way of government. Democracy, the profoundly good, is also the profoundly productive. When you've got to the point where you can celebrate the anniversaries of your 39th birthday, you can sit back sometimes, review your life, and see it flowing before you. For me, there was a fork in the river, and it was right in the middle of my life. I never meant to go into politics. It wasn't my intention when I was young. But I was raised to believe you had to pay your way for the blessings bestowed on you. I was happy with my career in the entertainment world, but I ultimately went into politics because I wanted to protect something precious. Ours was the first revolution in the history of mankind that truly reversed the course of government, and with three little words: we, the people. We, the people, tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us. We, the people, are the driver. The government is the car, and we decide where it should go and by what route and how fast. Almost all the world's constitutions are documents in which governments tell the people what their privileges are. Our Constitution is a document in which we, the people, tell the government what it is allowed to do. We, the people, are free. This belief has been the underlying basis for everything I've tried to do these past 8 years. But back in the 1960s, when I began, it seemed to me that we'd begun reversing the order of things. That through more and more rules and regulations and confiscatory taxes, the government was taking more of our money, more of our options, and more of our freedom. I went into politics in part to put up my hand and say, stop. I was a citizen politician, and it seemed the right thing for a citizen to do. I think we have stopped a lot of what needed stopping, and I hope we have once again reminded people that man is not free unless government is limited. There's a clear cause and effect here that is as neat and predictable as a law of physics. As government expands, liberty contracts. Nothing is less free than pure communism, and yet we have the past few years forged a satisfying new closeness with the Soviet Union. I've been asked if this isn't a gamble, and my answer is no, because we're basing our actions not on words, but deeds. The detente of the 1970s was based not on actions, but promises. They'd promised to treat their own people and the people of the world better, but the gulag was still the gulag, and the state was still expansionist, and they still waged proxy wars in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. Well, this time, so far, it's different. President Gorbachev has brought about some internal democratic reforms and begun the withdrawal from Afghanistan. He has also freed prisoners whose names I've given him every time we've met. But life has a way of reminding you of big things through small incidents. Once during the heady days of the Moscow summit, Nancy and I decided to break off from the entourage one afternoon to visit the shops on Arbat Street. That's a little street just off Moscow's main shopping area. Even though our visit was a surprise, every Russian there immediately recognized us and called out our names and reached for our hands. We were just about swept away by the warmth. You could almost feel the possibilities in all that joy. But within seconds, a KGB detail pushed their way toward us and began pushing and shoving the people in the crowd. It was an interesting moment. It reminded me that while the man on the street in the Soviet Union yearns for peace, the government is communist, and those who run it are communists. And that means we and they view such issues as freedom and human rights very differently. We must keep up our guard, but we must also continue to work together to lessen and eliminate tension and mistrust. My view is that President Gorbachev is different from previous Soviet leaders. I think he knows some of the things wrong with his society and is trying to fix them. We wish him well, and we'll continue to work to make sure that the Soviet Union that eventually emerges from this process is a less threatening one. What it all boils down to is this. I want the new closeness to continue, and it will, as long as we make it clear that we will continue to act in a certain way as long as they continue to act in a helpful manner. If and when they don't, at first, pull your punches. If they persist, pull the plug. It's still trust, but verify. It's still play, but cut the cards. It's still watch closely, and don't be afraid to see what you see. I've been asked if I have any regrets. Well, I do. The deficit is one. I've been talking a great deal about that lately, but tonight isn't for arguments, and I'm going to hold my tongue. But an observation, I've had my share of victories in the Congress, but what few people noticed is that I never won anything you didn't win for me. They never saw my troops. They never saw Reagan's regiments, the American people. You won every battle with every call you made and letter you wrote demanding action. Well, action is still needed. If we're to finish the job, Reagan's regiments will have to become the Bush Brigades. Soon he'll be the chief, and he'll need you every bit as much as I did. Finally, there is a great tradition of warnings in presidential farewells, and I've got one that's been on my mind for some time. But oddly enough, it starts with one of the things I'm proudest of in the past 8 years, the resurgence of national pride that I called the new patriotism. This national feeling is good, but it won't count for much, and it won't last unless it's grounded in thoughtfulness and knowledge. An informed patriotism is what we want. And are we doing a good enough job teaching our children what America is and what she represents in the long history of the world? Those of us who are over 35 or so years of age grew up in a different America. We were taught very directly what it means to be an American. And we absorbed almost in the air a love of country and an appreciation of its institutions. If you didn't get these things from your family, you got them from the neighborhood, from the father down the street who fought in Korea, or the family who lost someone at Anzio. Or you could get a sense of patriotism from school. And if all else failed, you could get a sense of patriotism from the popular culture. The movies celebrated democratic values and implicitly reinforced the idea that America was special. TV was like that, too, through the mid-60s. But now we're about to enter the 90s, and some things have changed. Younger parents aren't sure that an unambivalent appreciation of America is the right thing to teach modern children. And as for those who create the popular culture, well-grounded patriotism is no longer the style. Our spirit is back, but we haven't re-institutionalized it. We've got to do a better job of getting across that America is freedom. Freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of enterprise, and freedom is special and rare. It's fragile. It needs production. So we've got to teach history based not on what's in fashion, but what's important. Why the Pilgrims came here, who Jimmy Doolittle was, and what those 30 seconds over Tokyo meant. You know, 4 years ago, on the 40th anniversary of D-Day, I read a letter from a young woman writing to her late father, who had fought on Omaha Beach. Her name was Lisa Zanata Hen, and she said, "We will always remember, we will never forget what the boys of Normandy did." Well, let's help her keep her word. If we forget what we did, we won't know who we are. I'm warning of an eradication of that, of the American memory that could result ultimately in an erosion of the American spirit. Let's start with some basics. More attention to American history and a greater emphasis on civic ritual. And let me offer lesson number one about America. All great change in America begins at the dinner table. So tomorrow night in the kitchen, I hope the talking begins. And children, if your parents haven't been teaching you what it means to be an American, let them know and nail them on it. That would be a very American thing to do. And that's about all I have to say tonight, except for one thing. The past few days, when I've been at that window upstairs, I've thought a bit of the shining city upon a hill. The phrase comes from John Winthrop, who wrote it to describe the America he imagined. What he imagined was important because he was an early pilgrim, an early freedom man. He journeyed here on what today we'd call a little wooden boat. And like the other pilgrims, he was looking for a home that would be free. I've spoken of the shining city all my political life, but I don't know if I ever quite communicated what I saw when I said it. But in my mind, it was a tall, proud city built on rocks stronger than oceans, windswept, God-blessed, and teeming with people of all kinds living in harmony and peace. A city with pre-ports that hummed with commerce and creativity. And if there had to be city walls, the walls had doors, and the doors were open to anyone with the will and the heart to get here. That's how I saw it and see it still. And how stands the city on this winter night? More prosperous, more secure, and happier than it was 8 years ago. But more than that, after 200 years, two centuries, she still stands strong and true on the granite ridge, and her glow is held steady no matter what storm. And she's still a beacon, still a magnet for all who must have freedom, for all the pilgrims from all the lost places who are hurtling through the darkness toward home. We've done our part, and as I walk off into the city streets, a final word to the men and women of the Reagan Revolution, the men and women across America who for 8 years did the work that brought America back. My friends, we did it. We weren't just marking time. We made a difference. We made the city stronger. We made the city freer. And we left her in good hands. All in all, not bad. Not bad at all. And so, goodbye. God bless you. And God bless the United States of America.
Okay, so there was the Reagan farewell address. That was his last address from the Oval Office. You know, and I've listened to that before. I've heard it before. And, you know, it's been a long time since I've heard the whole thing. And that warning at the end kind of proved to be prophetic. Because what he was talking about there, you know, he, you know, they were able to get, he was able to get in there and kind of set things on a different direction, but he was worried about the fact that we basically, you know, we weren't teaching our history, so on and so forth, and that's what he was talking about at the end there. And that certainly has proved to be a major problem, and it may end up becoming our undoing. It could easily end up becoming our undoing. That is the real problem. You know, we can whine and moan and groan and complain all day long about the leaders that we have, but you know, and the lack of leadership and this and that. But in the end, that is brought about by the fact that that there are way too many people that in this country that have lost their way. We've been corrupted from one generation to the next. That corruption has continued and continued and continued to the point where it is today. There are still maybe half of the country, or maybe a little less, parents teach their kids what America is about, so on and so forth. But there's so many kids, so many young people, that have no clue. Their parents haven't taught them anything. The schools haven't taught them anything. They, you know, they're distracted. We've got all kinds of, you know, marvelous distractions. Distractions 24/7. And we've ended up kind of losing our way. And in a republic, representative democracy that we have, if you have too many people that end up in a kind of a suggestible, brainwashed state, then it becomes easy. You know, they're naturally going to elect the wrong people. They're going to put the wrong people in charge. And that's exactly what we've ended up doing. And right now we've got the wrong people in charge, and you know, in charge of the government. The government's expanding. It's becoming more and more bloated. And inevitably, if it continues in the direction it's going, it's going to end in a technological tyranny. It's going to be a tyranny like the world has never seen, and it's going to be enforced through technology. You know, they're going to try to regulate every little aspect of everyone's life that they possibly can. You know, and if they don't deem you worthy of being alive, you're dead. You know, if you're too old and sick, well, sorry for you, buddy. We'll just put you out of your misery like you have a racehorse that breaks its leg or something, or, you know, put a horse out to pasture. Well, or if you have a sick animal, what do? You just kill it, euthanize it. And that's what they view. The people that we've put in charge view people as animals that are just, you know, they're just animals for their pleasure. You know, and it was like I was saying a podcast or two ago, you know, just imagine that, you know, under the Obama healthcare plan, big government healthcare plan, just imagine that you're a married couple and a woman's pregnant, and it turns out, whoops, baby's Down syndrome, something wrong with it. Well, government says, hey, you have to abort it. We're not going to pay for that. You have to abort it. You're just a slave. Abort it. Get rid of it. It's worthless. And that's precisely what we're headed for. And, you know, for a long time, we've had this, this Social Security, you know, a so-called third rail that, the third rail on an electric train, you know, you touch the third rail and you're electrocuted. And politically, they've called Social Security the third rail. And if you try to touch it, you know, you're electrocuted. That's the, you know, you can't, there's been this idea that you can't do anything with Social Security, you can't reform it. Well, for a long time, the elderly population has been a huge voting bloc. You know, and there's been a lot of older people that have sort of voted so that they get their benefits. Now, I'm wondering how they feel. You know, how did they realize? Did the elderly people today, the people that are retired today, do they have any clue what this Obama, you know, what Obama has in store for them with this free, quote unquote, free healthcare, government run healthcare? I don't think they do. Of course, there's a lot of people that probably don't. There are people that now that are beginning to pay attention, but there's a lot of people that don't pay attention. They think, oh, well, that'll never happen here. It can't happen here. You know, there's so many insidious things in this Obama healthcare bill. You know, one of them is just they want to counsel. They want to have government-run counseling, you know, where they counsel, let's say someone's, you know, they're retired, you know, and I'd have to read the thing to find out, but they want to counsel retirees every 5 years. And basically what they want to do is just counsel, you know, maybe talk them into killing themselves. You know, especially if they're in nursing homes, they're a burden on society. Here, let's just inject you, put you out of your misery. You're a miserable old geezer. We'll just get rid of you. You have a bleak life anyway. You're in some government warehouse. Here, we'll give you this shot, and it'll put you out of your misery. Do people have any idea that that's what's in store for them? You know, so, but we have lost our way, and it's you know, you can blame the leadership, but ultimately, it's the bulk of the population has to be moral. The bulk of the population has to be in a non-brainwashed state. The bulk of the population has to be in a state of mind where they're in touch with their own common sense. And it was like he was describing, you know, then the people are at the, you know, decide how fast the government's going to go and whether it's going to turn or, you know, kind of at the control of the levers rather than the other way around. And it's the other way around. The government is looking at the population. They're looking at the population as just, well, we're in control of them. And if the thing's going to be, if it's going to be turned around, people are going to have to face reality. That's the biggest thing. You know, you can try to elect another leader or have some leader emerge, but, you know, ultimately, people are going to have to be inspired individually to face their own conscience. To connect with their own common sense. And then they don't need then you don't need government so much. You don't need someone holding your hand and offering you fake security. Because the security the government offers is fake. It's not real. It's an illusion. It's a lie. The only real security that there is if you have a relationship with your common sense. If you, in other words, you have a relationship with God, a real relationship with God, because that's it. That is the relationship with God. That's the bottom line. Whether you want to realize that or not. And if you run away from your conscience, you hate your conscience, you try to destroy your conscience, put distance between yourself and your conscience, you're running away from God, whether you want to realize that or not. And in order to do that, you're playing footsies with the devil. You're playing footsies with evil. Another way of looking at it, if too many people, rather than being connected to their common sense, if you're not connected to your common sense, then the only other choice is to be connected to evil. And then you're simply a slave of evil. Whether you want to realize it or not, you may think you're in charge of your own life, you may think you're in charge of your own thoughts, you're not. You're just a pawn. Something, some other force, some unseen force pulls the levers. Some unseen force pulls your strings and you dance like a stupid little puppet. At the same time that you've got this illusion that, the selfish illusion that you're in charge. But evil is in charge of you. If you either have a relationship with your common sense and you're moving closer, kind of ever closer to your common sense, or you're going in the other direction. There are no other choices. Either one way or the other. And so therefore, you're either going to be manifesting the good that comes through a right relationship with common sense, or you're going to be bringing hell on earth into existence. You're going to be manifesting the hell of the other direction. Anyway, probably better be cutting this off. I don't know if I'm going to be able to sleep. I might try to maybe sleep for an hour or two. I don't know. It's, what time is it now? It's about 3:23 a.m. And so let's see, 3:23 their time here. So 4:23, 5:23, 6:23, 7:23. So about four and a half hours or so. So I don't know. I may try to sleep for a couple of hours before they have me back into the dock, and then I'll, depending on how long it takes them to unload the load, then I'll probably come back, park back here again in the same place if they'll let me, and sleep some more, if provided they'll let me hang around here. I don't know if there are any truck stops right around Pittsburgh. That's the other thing. I really don't think there are any truck stops around here. There might be some that are hidden somewhere. Maybe I can do a Google search and maybe find some, but I'm really not aware of any. So if they won't let me hang out here, then I'm going to have to I'm going to kind of be screwed. I'm going to have to go somewhere, and so I can sleep a little bit more probably. So anyway, hope everyone had a great weekend. Hope you have a great week. And I will catch you later.
Remember, Trucker Tom is like Visa. He's everywhere you want to be.
Product reviews, restaurant reviews, photos, opinions, and more. Visit Trucker Tom's website at www.truckerphoto.com. You've been listening to Trucker Tom's podcast, and we'd love to hear what you have to say. All you have to do is send us an email to tom@truckerphoto.com.